Hello and welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists, and opinion makers who bridge our two worlds. This podcast was brought to you by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm Martha Legutsky, and I'll be your host today. Today we're going to hear from the elusive James Church, author of the acclaimed Inspector O novels, which include The Corpse in the Corio and Hidden Moon. I'm particularly excited to speak with Mr. Church today because he's just published his fourth book, and we're one of the first to be able to speak with him about it. What makes this even more exciting is the enigma behind James Church. The name is actually a pseudonym, and his voice has been altered for this recording. The author is a former Western intelligence officer who has spent a great deal of time in Asia. And there it is! All the information that you'll hear about him on his book jacket. So without further ado, let's move on to the interview, during which we'll hopefully illuminate a bit more about this man and his books. I'm now with Mr. James Church, who has just published the fourth of his Inspector O novels. It's called The Man with the Baltic Stare, and he has graciously agreed to speak with me today about his work. So thank you very much for being here, sir.
And I thank you. I've never been on a podcast. I've never been in a pod. And I'm very excited about this. Do I have to fasten my seatbelt, or how does this go?
I think you're all set.
Oh, good. All right.
How do you feel? How do you feel now that this fourth book is out and it's been received with a great deal of critical acclaim?
I see you have the books here sort of displayed very nicely in front of me, and I have to say they look like a little bit like my children, all lined up. I barely recognize some of them. They're all grown up now. I found that when I finish a book, once it leaves my hands, it's not part of me anymore. It has to stand on its own. I can't go back and fix anything. It's a lot of work to write, and so I'm very glad to see it walk out the door, go away to college or wherever it is it's going to go. Of course I'm glad when they do well, because you want readers to enjoy them. But people say sometimes to me, oh, aren't you proud? The book is whatever it is, and it's going to be like that forever. There's no chance to change it. So I'm perfectly happy to see them all together. I never, ever thought I would write four of them. If I had thought that to begin with, I probably would have written them differently. I wouldn't have killed off some of the characters the way that I did. But I'm just happy that they're out there now and that people are reading them. I love it when I see that people are checking them out of libraries. I think my publisher would be happier if people bought them, but when I see some little library in New England where some librarian has bought it, put it on the shelf, and someone has checked it out, I think to myself, wow, that's wonderful. That's just what I want.
Now, you refer to these books as your children, and you say that they walk out the door and you can't touch them anymore. Have you ever had instances where you are rereading your text and think to yourself, man, I wish I could just change that one word or that one sentence.
Yes, it happens. It happens a lot. Actually, two things happen. When I was going to write another book, I always had to read the others to make sure I wasn't repeating or I knew the history. Some passages I would read, and it would be the same passage that had given me trouble when I wrote it, and it wasn't right then, and I couldn't fix it, and I reread it, and I say exactly what you said. I think, oh, no, it still doesn't work. On the other hand, sometimes I'll read a passage and think to myself, whoa, who wrote that? That's not bad. I don't remember writing that. So it balances out, I suppose. Yeah.
These books have incredibly involved convoluted plots to some extent. And I would love to hear a little bit about how you map these out ahead of time.
The very short answer is I don't. And I had a journalist call me up once, very good journalist, and said to me, well, of course you map all these out. You have them all figured out before you write them. And I said, no, I don't. He said, what? Really? And I know that there are some authors who do that. They get 3x5 cards, or they'll pin things up on the wall, and they know what action will take place when, what the inner relationships between people are. I tried doing that with one of the books. My editor insisted that I map things out. And I found I couldn't write. It was like taking a dog for a walk. All the characters knew exactly where they were going to go, and they would say ooh and ah at the right place, but they really didn't feel the excitement of something happening that they hadn't expected. So I went back to my old way of doing things. The plots unfold much as intelligence unfolds in real life. That is, you don't know where the trail is going to lead. You really don't, as you're developing it. And sometimes extraneous things are thrown in that you hadn't anticipated, and they lead you off in another direction. And when you reach the conclusion, you discover you have more questions, and it isn't all tied up in the way you thought it would be. I find that a more credible way to write about North Korea, because I think even if you live in North Korea, you're left with multiple mysteries about what's going on around you, and yet you have to live with it.
So it sounds like I, as the reader, as I'm making my way through one of your novels, I can expect that you are actually, to some extent, uncovering the plot with me at any given point, because that's, you're relaying it, right, but also discovering it as you do so.
That's a good way to put it. Actually, it's not as if I'm in charge of the characters. I found that this cliche about how characters take over and act on their own as you're writing is absolutely true. At 2 o'clock in the morning, Inspector O will suddenly say something or do something that I hadn't anticipated. I hadn't even wanted him to do, and yet he did it. It's on the page, and we go off. We go off in another direction. Now, sometimes it absolutely doesn't work, and I say, no, this is... Can't,
so at least you have veto power on this.
Mostly veto power. But I can remember in Bamboo and Blood, I had wanted him to go into a disco in Geneva because I wanted to write a description of Inspector O in this with it disco with these flashing lights and writhing bodies and everything, and how he would respond. I couldn't get him to go into the disco. Because there was this big hulking guard at the door, and I couldn't get him past. So eventually they went off on another adventure, and I never got him into the disco.
You're not only an author by trade. You actually have already had a pretty well-established career in intelligence before you picked up the pen to start A Corpse in the Choreo. What inspired the shift into writing?
It came at... particularly frustrating time for me. And it was just serendipity. I had taken a plane trip with a couple of friends, and we all were reading and swapping detective stories on the airplane. And so when I got to the other end of this whatever 12, 15-hour flight, I naturally had lots of detectives running around in my head. And the next day we went and to a North Korean office to pick up our visas, and I was sitting, it's very quiet, and sort of thinking to myself in my jet lag state, I wonder if anyone has ever written a detective story about a North Korean detective. It just came out of nowhere, it just came to me. And I thought to myself, no, I don't think they have. So I think I will. It was that simple. And it became a challenge to me. And the title came to me immediately. Just popped into my head. A Corpse in the Choreo. I said, that's it. Okay, now I got to write a story. And it took me about 4 years to write that first book.
Is your knowledge of North Korea based at all on your career in intelligence?
It is, which has strong points and weak points when you're trying to write fiction. When you're doing work like this formally and officially, you're not encouraged to use your imagination. But in fact, good intelligence takes an imagination. You don't, obviously, you're not supposed to fictionalize things, but you have to be imaginative in order to fit disparate facts together in a way that makes sense, they're cohesive. And since you don't know for sure the linkages, you have to imagine what might be the case.
Now, you're in a rare position in that you are dealing with subject matter that very few people know anything about. So you actually could potentially use a great deal more creative license than perhaps somebody who would expect fact-checking to go on left and right. Does that ever prove advantageous to you?
When I began, I knew I did not want these books to be photographs of North Korea. They did not have to be precise in every respect. There are times in describing a scene, which I have in my mind, that I try to do a pretty good job. It's like an old photograph. It doesn't have the clarity of a modern camera, but still has the essence. Other times, I don't want it to be exactly according to the facts, either because it might be dangerous for someone, or because the specifics of that event or that situation are not really as important as the tone and the rhythm and the shading that comes off of it, because that's what you need to capture for the development of the character. People don't see facts with precision anyway. And these books are written from the standpoint of, they're first-person books, so they're written from the standpoint of Inspector O. So I have to see the world not as James Church saw it once upon a time, but as Inspector O sees it. And that's the challenge and to some extent the sense of enjoyment that comes from that.
Now, speaking of your characters, and particularly Inspector O, he is a very strong character. And has a lot of interesting habits and concerns. One in particular I'd love to ask you about is the woodchip preoccupation. Could you please explain where that comes from?
Where does that come from? Where does that come from? That's a good question.
Is that perhaps a bit of a mirror into your own life, or did that just come out of nowhere?
As a matter of fact, I became interested in carpentry. And I learned some of the skills from a very good, extremely meticulous and intellectual carpenter who treated, you know, lumber like sort of a living being with an essence, and sort of taught me that I'm not just dealing with planks, but I'm dealing with what once was living, a tree. And each one of these boards has its own sort of way of relating to the world, and I have to abide by that if whatever I'm building is going to eventually fit together and be strong. So I suppose Inspector O picked up some of that from me.
Well, I have to tell you, I now carry a certain disdain for pine, for example.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't think I'll ever buy another piece of pine furniture again.
That's true. Inspector O thinks pine is, and his grandfather did too. That's sort of the point. Pine is sort of common almost beneath contempt, you know, scrap pine or whatever he calls it. Right.
Exactly. So have you been to North Korea?
I have been in, over, around North Korea enough times, so I felt confident that, and Inspector O felt confident that I could write these books. There comes a point where if you're familiar enough with a subject, you don't have to know everything about it. If you're familiar enough with it, you can keep control of the essence of I don't want to phrase it. North Korea is a character in the books. Pyongyang is a character in the books. It's not just a backdrop. That's what some people like about it. It's integral to the books. But you have to know enough about it so you can keep it under control. Otherwise, it becomes cartoonish. So I had to feel that I knew enough. I had been there enough. I had breathed enough of the air and seen enough sunrises in the place that I could keep it under control and not let it run away into the James Bond tradition of the evil empire.
Have you ever met anybody in North Korea like Inspector O?
Many people. Actually, many people.
That's surprising to me because his tone at times can be rather aggressive and, well, not submissive as one would expect from a very strong top-down government system.
I was surprised too, I'll tell you that. They have, as does Inspector O, I met many of them who have wicked senses of humor. And it's not surprising because humor is a great defense mechanism. It's a way that you keep the world a little bit at bay and retain a measure of control, I think. But it also makes for good relationships because they know how to use humor to soften a situation that gets too confrontational sometimes. When the tone gets too heavy, they know how to lift it back up again. I was very surprised and impressed to see that. I think it's a saving grace in a culture when people can do that, especially when they have the weight of so many other things on their shoulders.
Well, as I read these books, I noticed that they're written in English, and it sounds like an American sometimes, perhaps by virtue of just the language. Is that something that you're aware of as you write? Does this, do you think, have an effect on your character formation of a North Korean character? Is he at all influenced by the fact that he's written about in English?
Very interesting. Yes, I would say so. Don't forget, these books are not supposed to be written as if I am a North Korean. The characters are North Korean, but the author knows that he is not. And therefore, I don't try to pretend that I can fit into their skin completely. I like to tell people that these books really are written at the boundary point where the two realities come in contact, where the North Korean reality comes in contact with the whatever the other world is, the Western world, whatever. And there are sparks that fly. And in every single one of the books, you'll see, Inspector O rubs up against foreigners. And that is where the tension is the greatest and where you can see in relief not only how Inspector O sees the world, but how the outside world frequently misperceives who North Koreans are. That, to me, is very interesting place to be and to observe. And that's one of the jobs that Inspector O has in the book.
How difficult was it for you to change writing styles from the more formal government report style to a fictional novel?
Surprisingly, not as difficult as I would have imagined for a couple of reasons. First of all, there are plenty of people who always accused me of writing fiction anyway, even in my official capacity. They didn't like my conclusions or what I was writing. Beyond that, when I wrote officially, I had to write according to a certain template. It had to be so long, it had to be, the opening had to be a certain way. And in some cases, it had to be very, 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 very short. So you had to condense your thoughts, you had to choose your words very carefully, and you had to be able to convey the nuance in a way that would instantly grab the attention of the reader, potentially someone with some authority, who was very busy and didn't have time to go through the 10 pages that you thought he really needed to read to understand it. Well, when you write a detective story like these are, especially a noir story, where the mood has to be a certain way, the characters are supposed to interact in a certain way, it's not constraining. I'm used to writing with these boundaries, In fact, that's the challenge. That's sort of the fun of it. And, you know, anybody can write an epic poem, but to write a sonnet, whoa, that's tough, you know, or a haiku. So I had, in some sense, I had some training in the discipline of writing. Moreover, this idea that I transferred from writing things about intelligence, real intelligence, to these books, that is how reality develops with pieces of information over time, that's very similar. I was very familiar and comfortable with that. So those things work pretty well. As for developing the characters, I don't know how this happened, but Inspector O jumped almost full-blown onto the pages. The other characters I had to layer carefully. I had to develop them like, you know, a piece of baklava with this phyllo dough. But Inspector O pretty much defined himself from the outset.
You've just made me forget what my other question was going to be. I had one in mind.
That was such a brilliant answer.
It was.
It blew me away. Thinking of baklava.
That's it. It's really that I'm just hungry.
You don't have any in this pod? I thought you'd have baklava.
No baklava today. Baklava. The reader is the obvious receptor of these books. But do you hold the reader in mind when you are writing these books? Are they an end point or are they simply an audience for something that you are creating no matter what?
I'll bet you that there's been a shift. The first book was just written to write because it was a challenge to myself. Subsequently, and I pay attention to what readers say, the internet gives you access to, for better or for worse, a lot of views of different readers. And you can't, you know, run around the field like a dog chasing a butterfly after each comment and criticism. But I get a sense overall of where I might need to shed a little bit more light or where some people don't like it, the way the character acts. And I just say to myself, well, that's too bad because that's what he's going to be. But I do have the reader in mind a little bit more. This is important. I'm not trying to write, a book for the masses. You know, it'd be nice to sell a lot of books. But I can't write down all the things that I think the reading public wants and say, okay, check, I put that in there, put that. It wouldn't work for me.
Where do you write?
Aha. If I told you where I wrote, that would...
You'd have to kill me.
I write in a very quiet place. Almost always late at night because it just seems that my imagination is freer and Inspector O is more awake. But during the day, I like to be around people. I've found since I started writing the books, my ears have become sharper and I listen to conversations. I'll sit in a restaurant by myself and listen to people talk and I begin to pick up rhythms and funny little quirks and how people communicate a great deal of information with a few words, with the tone of voice, you know, with a slight shrug of the shoulder. And that's the sort of thing Inspector O has gotten pretty good at doing, is interpreting a great deal of human emotion in a millisecond of interchange with someone.
And I find that you weave a great deal of information and important plot points into the text in a way that's not obvious. You don't hand it to the reader on a silver platter by any means. If anything, the reader spends some time trying to pick apart exactly what's going on in Inspector O's head. So to what extent do you think that a reader should be familiar with the subject matter in order to deduce certain plot points?
It actually is very dependent on individual readers. Some people read, how do I phrase this? Because I don't have any right to criticize readers. First of all, it'd be silly to do. And anyway, everybody reads a book according to who they are. what their past is, you know, what they're going through at the moment. But the books are meant to be read very carefully. People sometimes say, well, I didn't see any clues in here leading me to the plot. As you suggested, they're full of clues.
I imagine these books are great to read a second time because you get a lot of those aha moments pouring through them again and seeing, oh, you know, if only I'd picked up on this before. It's so obvious now.
Well, good. Read it. I hope you'll read it again then.
And that concludes our all too brief conversation with a fascinating author. For more information about James Church and his work, as well as upcoming KEI events, please check out our podcast page at keia.podbean.com. As always, please feel free to send any questions, comments, or suggested podcast topics to me at podcast@keia.org. I'd love to hear from you, so please don't be shy. Well, that's all for now. Thanks so much for listening. It was a pleasure to have you, and we look forward to seeing you next time on Korean Context. Bye.